Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathan Pindika's Park. Now on that occasion a pernicious view had arisen in a monk named Sati, son of a fisherman. Thus, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is the same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another. That has to do with the idea of reincarnation, and it is a Brahman view. They called them Brahmins during the time of the Buddha. They did not call them Hindus. Hindus didn't come into being until Madame Blavatsky, when she was traveling in India. So this view has to do with a permanent soul that goes from one rebirth to another. And as we all know, that doesn't work. You see individual consciousnesses arise and pass away when you get to certain places of your meditation. And that means birth, death, birth, death. So the Buddha taught rebirth, not reincarnation. And a lot of the Tibetans are very much into reincarnation. Finding a new Dalai Lama after the old one dies. I think it was the 8th Dalai Lama. And he got fed up with the politics. And he didn't like the way things were going. So he just disappeared. Started traveling on his own. After about 20 years, the monks said, well, he surely must be dead by now. So we have to go around and find his reincarnation. And they found him, and they made him the Dalai Lama. Then the old Dalai Lama came back. So much. And they have a very complicated way of saying, yeah, it can happen like that. I don't really understand it, so I'm not going to go into it. Anyway, several monks, having heard about this, went to the monk, and monk Sati, and asked him, friend Sati, is it true that such a pernicious view has arisen in you? Exactly so, friend. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another. Then those monks, desiring to detach him from that pernicious view, pressed and questioned and cross-questioned him thus. Friend Sati, do not say so. Do not represent the Blessed One. It's not good to misrepresent the Blessed One. The Blessed One would not speak thus, for in many ways the Blessed One has stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness. Yet, although pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by those monks in this way, the monk Sati, son of a fisherman, still obstinately adhered to that pernicious view and continued to insist upon it. Since the monks were unable to detach him from that view, they went to the Blessed One, after paying homage to him, sat down at one side and told him all that had occurred, adding, Venerable Sir, since we could not detach the monk Sati, son of a fisherman, from this pernicious view, we have reported this matter to the Blessed One. how Sati was the son of a fisherman, but he hated the smell of fish. And there were a lot of different monks named Sati during that time, so they had to be the son of Sariputta. Is a real interesting name. It means the son of Sari. Sari was his mother. His birth name was actually Upatissa. Anyway. Then the Blessed One addressed a certain monk thus, "Come, monk, tell the monk Sati, son of a fisherman." It's kind of a monk joke, because he didn't like the smell of fish. So they reminded him by calling him that. "In my name," that the teacher calls him. "Yes, venerable sir," he replied. He went to the monk Sati and told him, "The teacher calls you, friend Sati." "Yes, friend," he replied, and he went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One then asked him, "Sati, is it true that the following pernicious view has arisen in you? As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is the same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another." "Exactly so, venerable sir. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another." "What is that consciousness, Sati?" "Venerable sir, it is that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions." Misguided man, that's a really harsh thing for the Buddha to say. "To whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in that way, misguided man? Have I not stated in many ways consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness? But you, misguided man, have misrepresented us by your wrong grasp and injured yourself and stored up much demerit. For this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." Then the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "Monks, what do you think? Has this monk Sati, son of a fisherman, kindled even a spark of wisdom in this Dhamma and discipline? Anytime you hear the word wise or wisdom, it is referring to dependent origination." Okay. This is not what you get when you look it up in a dictionary. This is a Buddhist term, and you have to think like that. "How could he, venerable sir?" "No, venerable sir. When this was said, the monk Sati, son of a fisherman, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum without response. Then knowing this, the Blessed One told him, "Misguided man, you will be recognized by your own pernicious view. I shall question the monks on this matter." Then the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "Monks, do you understand the Dhamma taught by me as this monk Sati, son of a fisherman, does when he misrepresents us by his wrong grasp and injures himself and stores up much demerit?" "No, venerable sir, for in many discourses the Blessed One has stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness. Good monks, it is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me thus, for in many ways I have stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness. But this monk Sati, son of a fisherman, misrepresents us with his wrong grasp and injures himself and stores up much demerit, for this will lead to the harm and suffering of this misguided man for a long time. Okay, we're going to get into the conditionality of consciousness. Monk's consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on the eye and forms, it is reckoned as eye consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the ear and sounds, it is reckoned as ear consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the nose and odors, it is reckoned as nose consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the tongue and flavors, it is reckoned as tongue consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the body and tangibles, it is reckoned as body consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on mind and mind objects, it is reckoned as mind consciousness. Just as a fire is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it burns. When fire burns dependent on logs, it is reckoned as a log fire. When fire burns dependent on branches, it is reckoned as a branch fire. When fire burns dependent on grass, it is reckoned as a grass fire. When fire burns dependent on cow dung, it is reckoned as a cow dung fire. When fire burns dependent on chaff, it is reckoned as a chaff fire. When fire burns dependent on rubbish, it is reckoned as a rubbish fire. So too, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on the eye and forms, it is reckoned as eye consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the ear and sounds, it is reckoned as ear consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the nose and odors, it is reckoned as nose consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the tongue and flavors, it is reckoned as tongue consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on body and tangibles, it is reckoned as body consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on mind and mind objects, it is reckoned as mind consciousness. A general questionnaire on being. Monks, do you see this has come to be? Yes, venerable sir. Monks, do you see the origination occurs with that as nutriment? Nutriment is real interesting, and we'll get into that in just a minute. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, do you see with the cessation of that nutriment what has come to be is subject to cessation? Yes, venerable sir. Monks, does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus? This has come to be. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus? Does its origination occur with that as nutriment? Yes, venerable sir. Monks, does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus? With the cessation of that nutriment is what has come to be subject to cessation. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, is doubt abandoned in one who sees as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? This has come to be. Now, this is talking about the consciousnesses and the things needed for that consciousness to arise that I just got through reading to you. Yes, venerable sir, monks, is doubt abandoned in one who sees as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? Its origination occurs with that as nutriment. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, is doubt abandoned in one who sees as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? With the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, are you thus free from doubt here? This has come to be. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, are you thus free from doubt here? Its origination occurs with that as nutriment. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, are you thus free from doubt here? With the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, has it been seen well by you as it actually is with proper wisdom? Now he's asking them if they've seen it directly for themselves. This has come to be, yes, venerable sir. Monks, has it been seen well by you as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? Its origination occurs with that as nutriment. Yes, venerable sir. Monks, has it been seen well by you as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? With the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation. Yes, venerable sir. Now, when we were talking about hindrances arising, if you keep your attention on it, you're feeding that distraction. That's why the second part of the six R's is letting it be there by itself, not keeping your attention on it. So now you're not feeding it, so it's not going to keep coming back and back. Like that teacher that's been teaching for 50 years, still having fear arise when he gets in front of an audience. He keeps feeding it because he doesn't use the next step of the six R's, and that is relax. He lets go of that craving. And then he brings up something wholesome, a smile, and your object of meditation, and stay with your object of meditation for a long time, or as long as you can. See how the six R's really do make sense in every situation. So, become friends with the six R's. Use them as often as you can. Don't use the six R's as some kind of a stick to beat away things that arose. It's not for that. Sometimes things will go away by themselves. Other times, they're still going to stay there. And you go back to your object of meditation, your mind bounces back to that hindrance. As you stop feeding the hindrance gets weaker and weaker until it finally fades away. The hindrances are a necessary part of the practice because You have to be able to see what is distracting you and not feed it anymore. Monks, purified and bright as this view is, if you adhere to it, cherish it, treasure it, and treat it as a possession, would you then understand that the Dhamma has been taught as similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping? No, venerable sir. So don't be attached to the links of dependent origination, but observe how they arise. Monks, purified and bright as this view is, if you do not adhere to it, cherish it, treasure it, and treat it as a possession, would you then understand that the Dhamma has been taught as similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping? Yes, venerable sir. Now we're going to get into the nutriment. Monks, there are four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the support of those about to come to be. What for? They are physical food as nutriment, gross or subtle, contact as a second, preparations as the third, and consciousness as the fourth. Now, monks, these four kinds of nutriment have what as their source? What as their origin? From what are they born and produced? These four kinds of nutriment have craving as their source, craving as their origin. They are born and produced from craving. And this craving has what as its source? What as its origin? From what is it born and produced? Craving has feeling as its source. Feeling as its origin. It is born and produced from feeling. And this feeling has what as its source? What as its origin? From what is it born and produced? Feeling has contact as its source. Contact as its origin. It is born and produced from contact. And this contact has what as its source? What as its origin? From what is it born and produced? Contact has the sixfold base as its source. The sixfold base as its origin. It is born. They are born and produced from the sixfold base. And the sixfold base has what as its source? What as its origin? From what is it born and produced? The sixfold base has mentality, materiality, nama rupa, as its source. Mentality, materiality as their origin. They are born and produced from mentality, materiality. And this mentality, materiality has what as its source? What is its origin? From what is it born and produced? Mentality, materiality has consciousness as its source. Consciousness as its origin. It is born and produced from consciousness. And this consciousness has what is its source? What is its origin? From what is it born and produced? Consciousness has preparations as their source, preparations as their origin. They are born and produced from preparations. And this formations has what is their source? What is their origin? From what are they born and produced? Preparations have ignorance as their source, ignorance as their origin. They are born and produced from ignorance. Ignorance is a interesting word, and it comes from the verb to ignore. And what are you ignoring? How the links of dependent origination work. Okay, now we're going to go to the forward exposition on rising. Okay. So, monks, with ignorance as condition, with formations as condition, with consciousness as condition, with mentality, materiality as condition, with the sixfold base as condition, with contact as condition, with feeling as condition, with craving as condition, with clinging as condition, with habitual tendencies as condition, with birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair comes to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. This is how it arises. Now, an interesting thing, there is another sutta about the dependent origination, and it says, monks, there's the right way to teach and the wrong way to teach. The wrong way to teach is what we just recited. The right way to teach is the cessation and how it ceases. The monks over the years have become more and more fascinated with suffering. And in the Abhidhamma, it really stresses suffering a lot. Everything in life is suffering. That's not what the First Noble Truth is. The First Noble Truth is there is suffering in life. Not everything is suffering. In one way of looking at it. Now, if you look at it, everything that's impermanent is suffering. Yeah, I can go along with that. But for generally describing the First Noble Truth, don't focus on everything being suffering. I had a friend that was a Zen teacher, and he invited me to come to some of his classes that he was teaching. And he didn't give any instructions on how to do the meditation. And then when we got done sitting after 20 minutes or 30 minutes, he would bang his fist on the ground and he would say, "Everything is suffering." And I just couldn't go along with that, and I said, you know, I'm actually a little bit more interested in learning how to let that suffering go. And I didn't wind up going to his classes too often after that. Okay, the reverse order questionnaire on arising. With birth as condition, aging and death comes to be. So that now, do aging and death have birth as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Aging and death have birth as
with habitual tendencies as condition, birth comes to be. So it was said. Now, does birth have habitual tendency as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Birth has habitual tendency as condition.
With clinging as condition, habitual tendency comes to be. So it was said, now does habitual tendency have clinging as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? With craving as condition, clinging comes to be, so it was said. Now, does clinging have craving as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? With feeling as condition, craving comes to be, so it was said. Now, monks, does craving have feeling as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Craving has feeling as condition, honorable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With feeling as condition, craving comes to be.
With contact as condition, feeling comes to be, so it was said. Now, does feeling have contact as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Feeling has contact as condition, honorable sir. Thus you take it in this case. With contact as condition, feeling comes to be.
With the sixfold base as condition, contact comes to be, so it was said. Now, does contact have the sixfold base as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Contact has the sixfold base as condition, honorable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With the sixfold base as condition, contact comes to be.
With mentality, materiality as condition, the sixfold base comes to be, so it was said. Now, does the sixfold base have mentality, materiality as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
The sixfold base has mentality, materiality as condition, honorable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With mentality, materiality as condition, the sixfold base comes to be.
With consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality come to be, so it was said. Now, monks, does mentality, materiality have consciousness as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Mentality, materiality has consciousness as condition, honorable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality has condition.
With formations as condition, consciousness comes to be, so it was said. Now, does consciousness have formations as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? With ignorance as condition, formations come to be, so it was said. Now, do formations have ignorance as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Formations have ignorance as condition, honorable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With ignorance as condition, formations come to be.
Good, so you say thus, and I also say thus. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. That is, with ignorance as condition,
formations come to be.
With formations as condition,
consciousness comes to be.
With consciousness as condition,
mentality, materiality comes to be.
With mentality, materiality as condition,
sixfold base comes to be.
With the sixfold base as condition,
contact comes to be.
With contact as condition,
feeling.
With feeling as condition,
craving.
With craving as condition,
clinging.
With clinging as condition,
habitual tendencies come to be.
with habitual tendencies as condition,
birth
with birth as condition,
aging and death,
sorrow, lamentation,
pain,
grief, and despair comes to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of formations. With the cessation of formation comes the cessation of
consciousness.
With the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of
mentality.
With the cessation of mentality, materiality comes the cessation of with the cessation of the sixfold base comes the cessation of
contact.
With the cessation of contact comes the cessation of
feeling.
With the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of
craving.
With the cessation of craving comes the cessation of
clinging.
With the cessation of clinging comes the cessation of with the cessation of habitual tendency comes the cessation of
birth.
With the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This is the right way to teach. Do you want to hear a Dhamma talk that just talks about the suffering of everything, or do you want to hear a Dhamma talk about how to get rid of that suffering? Yes.
In the order of different origination, we have consciousness, which is the six types of consciousness.
No, it's not the six kinds of consciousness. It's the potential for it to arise.
The potential for it to arise. Because I was wondering why the six-fold base, the six senses, how come that's after?
Because that's the way it works. We'll get more into it in a minute, you'll see. With the cessation of birth comes the cessation of aging and death, so it was said. Now, do aging and death cease with the cessation of birth or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Aging and death ceases with cessation of birth. Thus we take it in this case. With cessation of birth, cessation of aging and death.
With the cessation of habitual tendencies comes the cessation of birth, so it was said. Now, does birth cease with the cessation of habitual tendencies or not, or how do you take it in this case? With the cessation of clinging comes the cessation of habitual tendencies, so it was said. Now, monks, do habitual tendencies cease with the cessation of clinging or not, or how do you take it in this case? With the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging, so it was said. Now, does clinging cease with the cessation of craving or not? Or how do you take it in this case? With the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving, so it was said. Now, monks, does craving cease with the cessation of feeling or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Craving ceases with the cessation of feeling, sir. Thus we take it in this case, with the cessation of feeling, the cessation of craving occurs.
With the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling, so it was said. Now, does feeling cease with the cessation of contact or not? Or how do you take it in this case? With the cessation of the sixfold base comes the cessation of contact, so it was said. Now, does contact cease with the cessation of the sixfold base or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Contact ceases with the cessation of the sixfold base, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case.
With the cessation of mentality, materiality comes the cessation of the sixfold base, so it was said. Now, does the sixfold base cease with the cessation of mentality, materiality, or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
The sixfold base ceases with the cessation of mentality, materiality, and sir.
With the cessation of consciousness comes the cessations of mentality, materiality, so it was said. Now, does mentality, materiality cease with the cessation of consciousness or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Mentality, materiality ceases with the cessation of consciousness, sir. That's what we take it in this case.
With the cessation of formations comes the cessation of consciousness, so it was said. Now, does consciousness cease with the cessation of formations or not? Or how do you take it in this case? With the cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of formation, so it was said. Now, do formations cease with the cessation of ignorance or not? Or how do you take it in this case?
Formations cease with the cessation of ignorance, terrible sir. Thus we take it in this case, with the cessation of ignorance, cessation of formation,
terrible sir. Good. So you say, though... You say thus, and I also say thus. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. That is, with the cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of?
Formations.
With the cessation of formations comes the cessation of? With the cessation of consciousness, cessation of?
Mentality,
with the cessation of mentality, materiality comes the cessation of?
Sixfold base.
With the cessation of the sixfold base comes the cessation of?
Contact.
With the cessation of contact comes the cessation of?
Feeling.
With the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of?
Craving.
With the cessation of craving comes the cessation of?
Clinging.
With the cessation of clinging comes the cessation of?
Habitual tendencies.
With the cessation of habitual tendencies comes the cessation of?
Birth.
With the cessation of birth.
Aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease.
Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Now, it says on this that with the cessation of feeling, there is a cessation of craving. We're talking about the gross craving, the big craving. I'm going to read to you another sutta, and this is going to show you how there is craving in each one of the links of dependent origination. So we're talking about the subtle craving. Every link of dependent origination is a form of suffering. Okay? And we have to learn how to let go of that suffering. Now, this is the Samyutta Nikaya. It's number 14. This is called Ascetics and Brahmins, number 2. At Sawati, monks, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who do not understand these things, the first noble truth, the origin of these things, second noble truth, the cessation of these things, third noble truth, and the way leading to the cessation of these things. What are these things that they do not understand, whose origin they do not understand, whose cessation they do not understand, and the way leading to whose cessation they do not understand? They do not understand aging and death. That's the suffering. Its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation. They do not understand birth, habitual tendency, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, mentality, materiality, consciousness, formations, their origin, their cessation. Excuse me. And the way leading to their cessation. These are the things that they do not understand, whose origin they do not understand, whose cessation they do not understand, and the way leading to whose cessation they do not understand. These I do not consider to be ascetics among ascetics or Brahmins among Brahmins. Now, the use of Brahmins here means somebody that has experienced Nibbana. And these venerable ones do not, by realizing it for themselves with direct knowledge in this very life, and dwell in the goal of asceticism and the goal of Brahmanhood. What this is saying is, if you don't know and see the links of dependent origination, you can't get off of the wheel of samsara. Now, but, the Buddha can use the word but, it's okay. As to those ascetics who understand these things, the origin of these things, the cessation of these things, and a way leading to the cessation of these things, and it goes through the whole thing again. These I can consider to be ascetics among ascetics and Brahmins among Brahmins. And these venerable ones, by realizing it for themselves with direct knowledge, in this very life enter and dwell in the goal of asceticism and the goal of Brahmanhood. In other words, you do attain Nibbana by seeing and realizing it. When you practice the Burmese form of straight vipassana, they will tell you that you get an insight knowledge called can't remember whether they call it the cessation or not. Sankaruupekka. Sankaruupekka. jnana. Sankara Rupeka. That it's seeing formations with equanimity. And when you get to a certain place, then you're going to see anicca three or four times in a row, very quickly, maybe even five times. Or dukkha three or four or five times very quickly in a row. Or anatta three or four or five times in a row. And then you have a blackout. And when you come back, you will start to see all of the insight knowledges all the way through. And that's considered attaining Nibbana. That doesn't agree with what I just read, does it? There's a real problem there. But an awful lot of people are convinced that they're Sotapanna or Sakdagami because of seeing this, seeing the equanimity to formations, and then seeing anicca, dukkha, anatta. That's why there's such a stress in straight vipassana on continually seeing anicca, dukkha, anatta, but they're seeing it intellectually. Now, when you get to the realm of infinite consciousness and you see individual consciousnesses arise and pass away very, very quickly, you're seeing impermanence. And it doesn't match what we normally think. You think you're seeing things, you're just continually seeing. But it's arising and passing away, arising and passing away very quickly. So you're not actually seeing impermanence up close and personal until you get to this stage. And you see the unsatisfactoriness of this continual arise and pass away, arise and pass away, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. And you see very, very clearly that you're not in control. There is no self. Now you're seeing this by your own direct knowledge, not a philosophy. So this is quite a bit different than what is being taught in straight vipassana these days. Okay. And there's always the question of how do you find a good teacher? What do you look for in a good teacher? And the Buddha gives us the answer right here. He said, monks, one who does not know and see as it actually is, aging and death, its origin, cessation, and way leading to its cessation, should search for a teacher in order to know this as it really is. In other words, look for a teacher that can show you how dependent origination works. From day one, what have I been telling you? How dependent origination works. And you will be successful if you follow these directions and don't add anything. Don't subtract anything. As you six are everything, you're letting go of that nutriment that keeps the wheel going. So you're letting go of this false belief in a personal self. Why? Because of that one extra step in your practice of relax. Recognizing that craving, letting the craving go. Relax. Then your mind becomes pure. And when you do that enough, you will actually... Don't fold your arms. You will actually see for yourself that everything in this world is part of an impersonal process. It has nothing to do with me. There is no I. A lot of people are very much afraid of anatta, especially the psychologist. Well, if I'm not there, then who is there? Well, you're seeing a process that's impersonal, that happens when conditions are right for it to happen. And the more closely you see and truly understand the impersonal nature of everything, the less suffering you have. So, this is really important for you to understand. And you're going to understand and see it for yourself. That's what a real teacher is about. Showing you how this process works and showing you how to continually let go of the cause of suffering. Now, I just got through reading a little bit ago about the Four Noble Truths in every link. Why does it arise? Because there is a little bit of craving there. And when you get to the place where you relax and there's no more conditions arising, that's Nibbana. What's missing a lot with the teachings of the Buddha right now is the learning to see directly for yourself how this process works. As you go deeper and deeper, you will start to see it more and more clearly. And that is the cessation of concepts. Remember I told you yesterday that we think in concepts. That's letting go of thinking. Letting go of all conditioned. And you will definitely not have any doubt arise that this was your experience. A lot of people, they've been hearing about Nibbana since they started practicing Buddha's path, and they have this big fireworks show that they think is going to happen. And when you have this experience of the cessation and very strong relief and joy and being able to see the little links as they come up. And I say, well, congratulations, you've just become a Sotapanna. And this has happened twice on this retreat. And the answer is that all? What is that all? You've just given up an ocean of suffering. Is that all? You're never going to have any doubt as to whether this really works or not. You're not going to take rites and rituals as a way to attain Nibbana. That means repeating a mantra over and over again, that sort of thing. You're going to know for a fact that everything is still, it is impersonal, but our own habitual tendencies are such that we still take things personally, but we don't get caught for as long. We're not going to break any more precepts. Your mind is going to tend more and more towards the wholesome, and it does it on its own. There is going to be personality change. Your perspective is changed now because of this one, is that all? Experience. Now this is pretty major, but no fireworks. Doesn't happen. It is a change in your perspective. It is a change that will insert itself into your daily life. And life becomes easier, more happy, more uplifted. That's the whole point, isn't it? So if you're looking for a teacher, find a teacher that is going to show you how this is as it really is. How these links of dependent origination really do work. How everything is impersonal. This happens all by itself when you use the six R's enough. This is a natural process. It's a simple process. Now you have to figure that the Buddha would not have become a real popular person if he came out with real complicated instructions in how to do the meditation. He had to make it simple because he was teaching farmers. They weren't educated. And they didn't have a lot of time to mess around. It had to work. It had to work fairly quickly. That's why coming to a 10-day retreat, a lot of people can be very successful on this retreat, following the directions. It works.
Does an Arahant who has a pure mind, does an Arahant think in concepts?
No. They don't think unless somebody asks them a question and then they give them the answer.
Does an Arahant ever take anything personally?
Never. They don't. Why would they? They don't have any craving or ignorance ever arising in their mind again. What relief, huh? Yeah?
But they would have feeling, correct?
Well, if they stubbed their toe, they would feel that they stubbed their toe.
But emotional?
No. No emotional feeling at all.
How about when they look at nature and flowers and things?
No. It lets go. I want is in your question, right? And they don't have any more craving. So that I want to look at something beautiful. It's still I want. They see it, but it doesn't,
there's no clinging.
No, absolutely not.
They see it and walk.
And there it is, and then they keep walking.
Are they happy all the time?
Absolutely.
So they don't need flowers. But they experience it without any clinging or craving.
Right.
Very freely.
Right.
Non-verbally.
Absolutely. They don't have any clinging in their mind at all. Is it worth it? Yes. Get off the wheel of samsara. If you saw how many tears you have shed in your rounds on the rebirth, they would fill up the entire ocean. That's how much sorrow and pain we have experienced. Arahats don't have that problem. In the Anguttara Nikaya, it talks about what happens when an arahat dies. And it's like you build a sandcastle right by the ocean, and a wave comes in and knocks the sandcastle away. All of those grains of sand are still there, but they can't get put back together in the same way. Exactly. Huh? Yeah. Only even more so. What holds us together? What keeps us on the wheel of samsara?
Craving
is the glue. Craving and ignorance both. So if somebody doesn't have any craving or ignorance, that is the highest form of contentment that you can ever experience. Okay? Now, no, it doesn't continue through rebirth and rebirth because you need all of them together to do that.
So what happens when they fragment into parts and get... What's the situation? Because you've described...
What's the situation with all of the sand that made the sandcastle?
Not with the arahant case, but with the ordinary non-enlightened person case.
They're held together by their craving and their... ignorance. And they keep going. And then you get all caught up in wrong ideas like Sati, son of the fisherman, does. that just lead on to more and more rounds of rebirth. Everybody here has been each other's brother, sister, father, or mother at some point in our rebirths. We're all connected. Good thing we're practicing loving kindness to all beings, isn't it? Yeah.
The link is broken.
And so is ignorance.
Yeah, and then go up. After that, it's all broken. Right?
Yeah.
So, which means if Arahat passed on, they will still have the formation consciousness?
No.
No, nothing?
There's nothing holding those together. Are they still there? Is there still consciousness? Yes. But it's not a... Right now, a lot of the scientists are starting to find out that the universe has a kind of consciousness. You can call that God if you want. I don't know. But there is a conscious thing that tends to create things and dissipate things. There is a kind of consciousness. I don't know how to explain it. I have just read it a few times. And the scientists are really coming to believe. I mean, everybody says, well, there's so much energy in space. If you take a cubic yard of space and tap into that energy, we don't need electricity. Things would light up by themselves. Yeah.
Do you recall the name of the scientist who you could quote that has written?
David Wilcox.
Okay.
He wrote a book. I don't remember the name of it right now.
The God Particle?
Huh?
The God Particle?
No.
Synchronous.
No. Not David Wilcox. He has about 1,500 references in the book from other scientists saying the same thing that he's saying. And he graduated from college, but he never went any further. And because of that book that he wrote, he's getting an honorary PhD. Because he has so many references in it. It's WILCOCKS. He has a website called Divine Cosmos. And if you go to there, divinecosmos.com. If you go to there, he has his books that he's written. And they're pretty scientific. They're pretty pretty believable.
But, Bundy, I'm still puzzled about one thing, which is you're saying at one stage of your lecture tonight that human beings do not reincarnate, that we dissolve.
No, I didn't say dissolve. Rebirth. There is birth, death of every consciousness. That's not dissolved.
It's not dissolved. So it's held together.
Held together with
craving. Yeah.
Okay.
Got it. So in that way, that would make sense that therefore an Arahant doesn't survive because he's not held together with craving.
Right. There is no more becoming. What a relief.
So
you don't have to be a teenager anymore.
So it just occurred to me then that what we're doing is sort of, my favorite word, deconditioning our habitual, unconscious habitual tendencies.
Yes.
Gradually, and so they sort of, you know, so first path knowledge, and then first path fruition, second path knowledge and fruition. These are gradual degrees of deconditioning this unconscious,
right,
reactive habitual,
right,
pattern to the, and then the pure being, the Arahat, just doesn't create any more habitual,
right,
unconscious habitual.
Right.
They're basically, the blackboard is wiped clean.
Yeah. And think about the advantage of somebody you can walk up to and ask a question and they don't have any agenda. They're just going to tell you exactly, this is the way it works.
Let me know when you find it.
Yes.
Well, I'm maybe. We'll have to wait and see. Yeah.
Did you ever want to be an Arahant?
Always. From the very first time I heard about this stuff, I wanted to get off the wheel of Sansara. I've gone through enough mud. Because of the Buddha. Yeah.
And once the Buddha left, then that just slowly.
Yeah. Yeah, the Buddha Dhamma is only going to last for 5,000 years. And it's going to disappear for a long time. Until another Buddha comes around. Well, they're in the Tusita heaven. One day in Tusita heaven equal 400 years here. They live to be at least 100 years. So how many years is that? It's a long time. This is called a Buddha era. And there can be, according to what Usilananda told me, there can be up to 6 Buddhas in a Buddha era. So they're born fairly close together. I mean, everything is going to be changing. One of the ways you know that the Buddha era is going to be coming is the lifespan of human beings is going to go down to about 10 years. And then it's going to start getting longer again. And that's before the next Buddha comes. Well, why does it have to be on this planet?
And so we must all be really lucky and fortunate.
This is so fortunate to be born this close to a Buddha. Oh man. Yeah. I used to say that to Usilananda. How much luckier can we get to be born in a Buddha era and still have the teachings in reasonably good shape? This is really lucky. We've done a lot of good stuff
to be able to get here. And Ledi Sayadaw, who was, they say somebody like Ledi Sayadaw only gets reborn about 1 in 100 years. He said that this Buddha era is called the era of the saints. And when you become a Sotapanna, you do become, quote, a saint. You don't have to have miracles happen, but there is a miracle that happens. You attain Nibbana. That's a pretty good miracle. Right? So it's a real interesting phenomena that we're lucky enough to be around in this time. And there's so much bad stuff that's happening out there. Who cares? It doesn't matter. What matters is what you do. And how do you affect the world around you? And one of the things that has become real popular is taking a bodhisattva vow. And the Mahayanas, they encourage it. The Vajrayanas, they really encourage it. Renounce getting off the wheel. Renounce Nibbana so that you can stay around and help all beings attain Nibbana. Well, is that realistic? Because the Buddha couldn't do it. All beings? If he could, we wouldn't be here. But people that take a bodhisattva vow, and I run across this quite often. People come and they want to do a retreat, and I ask them if they've taken the bodhisattva vow, and they say yes. And I ask them seriously, do you want to attain Nibbana in this lifetime or not? If you keep the bodhisattva vow, the nature of the bodhisattva vow is very serious, and it will stop you from attaining Nibbana. What is a bodhisattva vow? It's a vow so that you can become a future Buddha. Now, there's three different kinds of Buddha. Gotama was an intelligent Buddha. It only took him 4 Mahakappas and 100,000 lifetimes to become a Buddha. That's very intelligent. There's another kind of Buddha that's called I can't think of the name. The last one is a moral Buddha. Okay, a moral Buddha. Energetic, you're right. And he has to be a bodhisattva for 8 Mahakappas and 100,000 lifetimes before he becomes a Buddha. The last is a moral Buddha. He has to hang around for 16 Mahakappas and 100,000 lifetimes. Now, a Mahakappa is an expansion and contraction of the universe. That's one. So it takes a huge, long, long time to become a Buddha. And almost all people that take a bodhisattva vow now, after a few thousand lifetimes, for 100,000 lifetimes, they'll start to go, oh, this is way too hard. And they will renounce the vow, but they're not in a Buddha era anymore. So they're caught on the wheel of samsara because of taking this bodhisattva vow. It says in some of the Theravada writings that the only people that can become a true bodhisattva has to take the vow in front of a Buddha. And the Buddha looks into the future to see whether they're tough enough to go through all of the pain that they have to go through to become a Buddha. That they have they have to develop their parami to perfection. Parami, never telling a lie. For mahakappas. Practicing loving kindness to perfection. Their determination has to be perfect. So there's all of these different qualities that they have to develop to perfection before they can become a Buddha. And it takes a lot of lifetimes to do that. So when somebody comes and they said they've taken a bodhisattva vow, I give them the choice. I don't care whether they renounce this or not. But I give them the option. If you want to attain Nibbana now, when you become a Sotapanna, you're never going to be reborn less than a human being. Not a hungry ghost or in a hell realm or any of that animal realm. So if you want to attain Nibbana in this lifetime, you have to renounce the bodhisattva vow. And it's done fairly simply. You go in front of a Buddha image with a very solemn mind. And three times after bowing to the Buddha image, you say out loud, I now renounce the bodhisattva vow. And if you've taken the bodhisattva vow in the past, and you renounce it, you feel like you've had a big weight taken off your shoulders. But some people are really in love with the idea of being a bodhisattva. And okay, fine. I can teach you up to the realm of neither perception or non-perception, but you're not ever going to go any further than that because a bodhisattva vow is so strong that it stops you from going further. And I'm honest with them. I say, you can do that or not. It's your choice. And I have had a few Mahayana monks and nuns that have renounced that. But in Asia, as for example, Korea, they have recitations that they do, and they're taking a bodhisattva vow. They don't recognize it as such, so they're being tricked into it. Yeah. And there's a lot of teaching in Vajrayana Buddhism about how good it is to be a bodhisattva and how selfish people are if they just want to attain Nibbana now. And I don't consider that selfish. I've had Mahayana friends that they look at the work that I'm doing and they're saying, you know, you're a true bodhisattva, but you haven't taken the vow. because I spend my time helping other people to be happy. How to let go of the suffering. So it's just because you attain nirvana, you have a tendency to start helping other people and being kind to other people and showing other people how to smile and be happy. Well, that's what a bodhisattva is supposed to be doing all the time. But how many people actually do that after they've taken the vow? They're in love with the idea of it, but when it comes down to the actual practice, it doesn't work so well. Yeah.
So, will samsara is not so attractive?
No, there's a lot of suffering.
What's the alternative? Buddha's world. So, could you please describe to us?
What are you talking about, Buddha's world? Nibbana is beyond that.
Okay, so how about the arahat?
It's beyond that. There is no more becoming. They've done what had to be done to get off the wheel of samsara. And when they die, there is no more of that being. Just like the Buddha. There is no Buddha around. I've been in Buddhist countries where they pray to Buddha like they pray to Jesus. And I always kind of laughed at that, because why are you praying to nothing? Why don't you practice what the Buddha taught instead of pray to get some kind of advantage? That falls under rites and rituals, yes.
I'm thinking about what you said about Bhikkhu Bodhi last night, and the implication that I got was that there's a hard path and an easy path, and you're teaching the easy path. He took the hard path. Okay, so far?
Well, you can become a Sotapanna or a Sakadagami without doing any meditation. It depends on your understanding. There are a lot of scholars that have become Sotapanna because they go so deeply into the Dhamma that their understanding is great and they have this kind of experience. But the only way to get off of the wheel is through meditation. And that means anagami and arahatship. And there's other suttas that talk about this. There is something that's called acchula sotapanna. Acchula sotapanna means a little sotapanna. And a little sotapanna is somebody that's experienced Nibbana one time and they never get the fruition until right before death. But this is called acchula sotapanna. You can still be tempted to drink alcohol, break precepts, and as soon as that happens, they're no longer a sotapanna. There was a monk that did a lot of writing. He was Venerable Kema. And he showed in the Samyutta Nikaya where it says that once you attain any stage of sainthood, you will have the fruition of that experience right before you die. And now this was in the Samyut Nikaya, and I've since lost the book that had those references in it. Much to my chagrin, because I had all of that stuff in a computer and it crashed. And of course I didn't save that stuff. I had written about 3/4 of a book on attaining Nibbana and fruition. I don't even have the notes to it anymore. We had some hurricane come through and take away a lot of that stuff. And I can't find another copy of that book. It was a booklet. It was like a wheel publication. Very small little booklet, but it had a lot of references that I went to and checked out, and I talked to some of my Pali scholar friends to see whether it was really true. But that happens. Anyway. I'm going to have to finish the dependent origination tomorrow night. I didn't know I was going to get that. One of my teachers, he was a meditation teacher, and if my mind started going too deep into meditation while I was listening to a Dhamma talk, he would always say something that made me laugh. And somebody would ask him a question, and he already had planned that he was going to give this Dhamma talk. And at the end of the talk, he said, "And my talk has gone astray." And that's what just happened to me. No, that was Ujjanika. So, you have any more questions? We have a little bit more time. We can do it.
So, how many sotapanas has Bhante created already?
How many sotapanas is
Bhante taught already?
Well, we just started keeping track of it. In Indonesia, it's about 100. It just started happening in 2012 when that energy shift happened. Everybody started understanding more, and they started following the directions more closely. I can't explain why. In this country, what do you think? 30, 40, 50, maybe? How many sotapanas have I taught? And it's not only sotapanas. I mean, there's people that have gone beyond that, but they've been successful. It's probably a little bit over 100 in Indonesia.
They're ahead of us. Come on, let's go.
Well, there's a lot more people that come for the retreats than they do here.
We've got to do more retreats, that's the thing. Oh. We've got as many as they got in the retreat.
This time.
Well, it's a numbers game now.
Yeah.
Okay, Bhante, we're going to work. Like San Juan Batista.
Yeah.
So, going back to Bhikkhu Bodhi, does that mean that because he's on the hard path, it ends at some point?
No. He is a very virtuous monk. And because of that, I suspect quite strongly that he's going to be reborn in a Devaloka. Probably he has, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that he's made a determination to be reborn in the Tusita heaven where the Bodhisattva Maitreya is hanging out. I suspect. I don't know for sure. Yeah.
So, question. When you get to that level, you can pick and choose where you want to go.
If you're very virtuous, yes. Not in the Brahma lokas, only the Deva lokas. I'll show you the sutta that shows you how to do it, if you want. Yeah.
Is rebirth, and in general the three knowledges, is that something which is individually verifiable?
The three knowledges?
Right.
Yes, absolutely. I have students that have been successful with that. Remembering past lifetimes is it's a piece of cake. It really is. And then you start developing your divine eye and divine ear, so you go to the heavenly realms and the hell realms and ask them what they did to get there. You know, that kind of thing. That reminds me of a joke. There was this guy that died. And he had a marginal life. He did some really good things. He did some really bad things. And he meets this deva and he says, well, show me the different realms that I can be, that I can go to. So he shows him the heavenly realms and there's devas flying around and they're all dancing and singing and having a great time. Okay, take me to one of the hell realms. So he takes him down to a hell realm and he sees these people in this room and they're standing in excrement right up to their lower lip and they're whispering something. And it got his curiosity going. And he said, okay, you want to go to the heavenly realm? You want to go to this hell realm? Here. He said, I got to find out what they're talking about. I said, okay. So he winds up with excrement up to here. And he gets close to what somebody is saying. And they're saying, don't make waves. So be careful of your curiosity. Yeah, there's some yeah.
In the suttas, is there any talk of people dying and then coming back? There's so many stories and books.
Actually, what happens is their consciousness kind of separates from their body for a period of time. They look down and they see their body and people working on them and helping. And the connection between mind and body is not broken. If it was broken, they would keep going. But I know there's a lot of stories about visiting some of the lower heavenly realms and that sort of thing. And then being told that they have to come back. It's because that connection hasn't been broken.
Historically documented cases where people go into a deep trance, get stuck in a box, and then lowered away, and then they're sort of brought up again a few several days later, unbelievably long times, like 7 or 8 days later, and they're still alive, they're still breathing, but they're at a very low metabolic level.
Right.
And they kind of reassemble their normal metabolism.
Yeah. I've heard about those kind of things too.
Yeah, then sort of yoga, sort of.
Yeah. When I was in Malaysia, there was this yogi that came through, and he had people put dirt on top of him, and there was a big mound like that, and then they placed grass seed on it, and he stayed like that. He wasn't able to move, and he stayed like that for, I think it was 9 days, and the grass was growing out. I mean, it was pretty amazing.
He was a showman.
Yeah. Yeah, a show off. But those are tricks. And I thought, how'd he go to the bathroom? You know, that's uncomfortable to be like that for 9 days. No food, no drink, no nothing. They didn't cover his head completely. His nose, he could still breathe. But they had grass over his head, so you can see that it wasn't broken. He didn't have a chance to get out of it. Interesting. And I was in Malaysia when they, every year they have this huge Hindu ceremony, and they take skewers and put it through their cheek and their tongue and coming out the other way. They take these hooks that are about as thick as my finger, and they hook 15 or 18 of them on the back. There's no blood. And they take straps and put on the hooks, and they start pulling back. But they're also carrying this huge headdress thing that must weigh maybe 100 pounds. And they go up over 300 stairs with somebody pulling back on them. And there's no blood. And I used to have some postcards of that. And it was so disgusting, I got rid of them. But when they were pulling, you could see they were really pulling because the skin was being pulled back. And that's one of the ways that they talk about, you know, how Catholics talk about sin. Well, that's what they think too, and this is their penance for doing it. And there was a Westerner that was doing that. He did it every year for 7 years in a row. It's really an amazing thing. There's hundreds of thousands of people show up to see this. Pretty amazing. I don't see any advantage to doing that, but who am I to judge? So those kind of things can happen, but it's pretty rare. Anything else? Questions? Got your chance. You know what happened to those monks that didn't ask the questions? Yeah.
So you mentioned that because the conscious and body were too connected, that's why the person came back.
Yeah.
So did Buddha discuss
saying? No, he didn't talk about that too much. He didn't talk about that too much. Okay. And I have never read it in the suttas themselves. I have read it in the commentaries. And maybe the commentaries are right and maybe they're not. It is one person's opinion. Okay. There's something that's real interesting here. And I wanted to read it to you real quick. So when I tell you there is no body, you'll actually believe me? This is about mentality, materiality, namarupa. Okay. And what is mentality, materiality? What is its origin, cessation, and way leading to its cessation? Feeling, perception, formations, contact, and attention. These are called mentality. Feeling, perception. Okay? That means when you're in a mental realm, there is no body. Yeah, but I feel it. I got a pain right here. No, you don't. You have a pain right here. And it feels like it's here, but it's not. It's a pain in your mind. It is a meditation pain. Don't give in to it. Keep 6R-ing it, but it doesn't go away when I 6R it. Well, it's, you got a strong attachment there that you have to let go of. When you 6R it enough, it will disappear on its own. And your mind will be much more clear and bright. Okay? What is mentality? What did I just read?
Feeling, perception,
attention,
contact. Formations, contact, and attention. If it's real pain, it doesn't go away when you get up and start walking. If it's meditation pain, it is mental. Okay? What is materiality? It's the four elements. Earth, fire, water, air. And the mixture of those. That's what materiality is. Interesting, huh? So you're in an arupa jhana. I don't want to hear about your body. You don't have one at that time. You're in a mental realm. Oh, but my knee hurts so much. No, it doesn't. Your attachment to a hindrance hurts. Okay? Be careful, I'll bark at you if you tell me about your body. You don't have a body. Why don't we share some merit?
May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long to the blessed dispensation. Sa, sa, sa.